a very big thanks to the 2FM Drive team for getting the evening underway. It is Wednesday the 24th of September and you're listening to Game On with me, Andrew O'Connor. Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, we'll get Nadine Doherty's thoughts on the continuing amalgamation of the GA, the Camogie Association and the Ladies Gaelic Football Association. Less than 44 hours away from the start of the Ryder Cup, we'll hear the European and American perspectives from Beth Page as Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson join us from the New York course, and Keith Tracy joins me to talk all things football. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552 or WhatsApp us to 087 187 9200.
This is 2FM's Game On.
And before we get into a very busy programme, let me give you the brief headlines of the day so far from the world of sport. The opening ceremony for the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black in New York will take place at 9 o'clock Irish time tonight. The ceremony has been brought forward owing to the expected poor weather tomorrow. Celtic are away to Red Star Belgrade tonight in the Europa League this evening, while Notts Forest are at Real Betis. Alan Kelly, the head of the Committee on Media and Sport, has criticised FAI executives for the delay in coming before politicians, having been invited in last July. And Roisin Rian made it a hat-trick of medals at the World Para Swimming Championships by claiming silver in her 100 metres backstroke final.
Roisin, that's your third final and your third medal. You have to be delighted with that silver again.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy with that swim. That hurt the most that 100 backstrokes probably ever hurt. I'll have to go back and have a look. I'd say I took that out pretty hard because I definitely felt it in that last 25, but you know, that's what I've been trying to do for a while now, is to get out that bit quicker, so hopefully that's what I did. And yeah, really happy to, my PB was 2 years old, so I'm happy to have come out and got a new one.
And Mark Allen progressed to the third round of the British Open snooker in Cheltenham, but 18-year-old Irish player Leon Crowley is out. Irish basketball star CJ Fulton has signed a contract with the NBA's Minnesota Timberwolves, and Spanish Harlem, trained by Willie Mullins, made the most of the running under Dally Mullins to register a decisive success in the Guinness Kerry National Atlas Stole.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Keith Tracy joins me in studio. Keith, happy Wednesday to you.
Happy Wednesday, Andrew. Happy Wednesday, everybody.
Yeah, and let us start with last night's football, because Liverpool continued their winning ways. They were at home to Southampton. Did you see the game?
I seen it, yeah. I watched it at home.
How was Isaac?
He was all right. He scored a goal, but I think Southampton playing out from the back, they caused their own problems. They went and nicked the ball off the Southampton centre-half, and Chiesa just turned around and gave it to him. It was a lovely, sharp finish from Alexander Isak, but there's some big talking points within the game. Southampton hit the crossbar, and they had a follow-up header that they really should have scored from and missed. You know, I think it was 90 seconds later, Liverpool go up and make it 1-0. And Southampton do really well to get themselves back into the game. They make it 1-1. But Liverpool, as they have been doing this season, they have the late show. And Ekitike steps up and taps one in from about 2 yards away. And look, I've no real problem with the emotion getting a hold of Ekitike, taking his jersey off. But this is very, very early stages of the League Cup to be doing that. And the fact that it was a tap-in, I thought Slot was brilliant. I'm sure we're going to hear from him in a few minutes. But I thought his interview was brilliant, because as soon as Ekitike tapped it in from a yard, I thought, it's a little bit of an overreaction. You haven't exactly gone past 5 people and smashed it in the top corner. But Arne Slot was brilliant after. He said he should have went straight over to Chiesa, because he was the one that made the goal. And the fact that the fourth yellow, Andrew, he just smacked the ball away, is really, really silly. But I'm sure it's just a learning curve for a young man coming into a new league.
And what about Freddie Church, or Federico Chiesa, as they call him back home? I mean, he is a brilliant player, and he's been very patient. Very impressive comments from him after the game. I don't know whether you read them, but I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Chiesa. I've seen a lot of him playing for Juventus, and I've seen an awful lot of him playing for Italy. And the more I seen him, I thought, this is a brilliant signing Liverpool have made. And I think it was in the region of 13 million last season they signed him
for.
Yeah,
great, so money.
Absolute snippet for somebody of the talent he has. And I know he's probably not going to be first choice with Salah has that right wing lockdown. You'd imagine with Florian Wirtz and Ekitike and Isak now that maybe he's gone a little bit further down the list. But he's done really well since he came in the door, and with his injury worries that he's had and his fitness problems, delighted to see him get two assists last night.
Yeah, and he basically said he was asked, would you not go to a different club? Or, and he said, you know, I'm in one of the biggest clubs in the world. There's going to be brilliant players here. I came for the competition. If I'd wanted sort of more minutes on the clock, I would have joined a different club. But I'm here and I want to be here.
It's exactly what fans would be thinking. How often have you heard players think, oh, well, I'm not playing, I want to leave. But this fella's saying, I'm at a great club, I want to fight for my place. And I absolutely love that. But when you've got the talent of a Federico Chiesa, you should be fighting for your place. And like I say, although Salah has that right wing lockdown, I'd love to see him play a little bit more.
Let's hear from the Liverpool manager, Arne Slot, and talked a lot about the red card for Ekitike.
It's always the best to control your emotions. And if you cannot control your emotions, do it a way that it doesn't lead to a yellow card. So I think I said when I got my red card against Everton, that's always stupid. Because it is, you can show your emotions, but if it leads to a yellow or red card, then it's stupid. And that's what happened in the first yellow. And then I told him as well, and I said it to numerous media already, if you score in the Champions League final in the 87th minute after outplaying three players and hitting it in the top corner, I can maybe understand that you are like, ah, this is all about me. What did I do? But I'm old-fashioned. I'm 47. And old, maybe. And I haven't played on this level, but I did score a few goals. And if I would have scored a goal like this, I would have turned around and walked up to, in this situation, Federico Chiesa and say, this goal is all about you. This is not about me. So yeah, needless, not smart. You call it stupid. I call it stupid, by the way, as well.
Yeah, he was right. It was stupid.
Absolutely spot on. Both of them were absolutely stupid.
Yeah. Also, last night, Wolves, as you said a couple of minutes ago to me off air, they can't buy a win in the Premier League, but in the League Cup, they've beaten now two Premier League teams. Aston Villa they beat in their first round, and 2-0 victory over Everton last night.
Yeah, they seem to be just turning up for the League Cup at the minute. Wolves, great to see Matt Doherty starting at right back. And you look through that Wolves team and there's not an awful lot of players that you'd imagine the rest of the Premier League teams would be thinking, you know what, we'd have him in our team. They seem like a bog standard enough group of players, but look, I'm sure with the manager getting a new deal not so long ago, no Premier League points on the board. He needs to start getting Premier League wins and, you know, just getting the performances moving, because it's been so sporadic, as you say, doing okay in the Cup, beat two Premier League teams already. But in the Premier League, the pressure is really starting to mount.
A couple of other big results. Brighton, 6-0 winners at Barnsley. Cardiff City had a 2-1 victory over Premier League Burnley, and Callum Robinson on the score sheet for Cardiff last night. Fulham 1-0 winners over Cambridge, and Chelsea as well, 2-1 winners at Lincoln City. So no major surprises. Good to see Callum Robinson get on the score sheet.
Yeah, great to see Callum Robinson get on the score sheet. There's obviously a couple of Irish heads in Cardiff, a couple of Irish heads in Burnley as well. The Burnley team was, you know, it was a second string team, to put it nicely. And, you know, I do think of Conor Hourihan, the Barnsley manager. I think he is younger than me, 2 years younger than me. So to be managing a Barnsley team up against a Premier League outfit like Brighton and to be pumped 6-0, I'm sure it's not the end of the world for Barnsley. A lot of learnings to be done, and I'm sure Conor will be thinking exactly the same. They'll take an awful lot of learnings out of that game.
Some of the other big hitters in action in round three of the EFL Cup tonight. Man City at Huddersfield, Newcastle United host Bradford City, Spurs are at home to Doncaster Rovers, and Arsenal travelling to Port Vale. So we should have a bit more action. Any of those you're looking forward to other than Arsenal?
Oh yeah, I am looking forward to Port Vale and Arsenal. I look at Newcastle and Bradford and Spurs and Doncaster, and the fact that the big Premier League teams are at home there, you'd be very, very surprised if Bradford were to do anything up in Newcastle. The same with Doncaster, I'd be very, very surprised if they were to do anything. Couple of older heads in the Doncaster dressing room. Billy Sharp is a player I would have played with at Sheffield United. Sean Graham as well, Bowes fans would be very familiar with. And the fact that Manchester City are away to Huddersfield, Lee Grant is the gaffer there now. I would have played with him at Burnley as well. Very good goalkeeper in his time. So hopefully, I'd love to see a joint killing, Andrew, but I'm not so sure it will happen tonight given the strength of the Premier League teams that we see out on show tonight. But I think everybody loves a joint killing, but I'm not so sure we'll see it.
Now, the League Cup, you have your own memories of the League Cup and you have some memories that you can't remember. So let's start with the one you can't remember, actually. You played the full 90 minutes against Manchester United at Old Trafford and I think you only lost 5-3.
Yeah.
And you have no memory of it.
Yeah, only lost 5-3. Very, very sporadic memories of this. This is when Google helps you out from time to time, but... Yeah, apparently I played 90 minutes in Old Trafford against United. This was, I think it was the last 16. But I'm looking back at the Blackburn team and obviously Benny McCarthy, Rocky Santa Cruz, two guy, Robbie Fowler come off the bench towards the end. And the likes of Tevez, Nani, Ryan Giggs, Gary Neville, John O'Shea, Patrice Evra, Paul Scholes on the pitch that day. And yeah, geez, I just wish I had better memories for you. I can't remember the game. I can't recall it whatsoever. There was no highlights, just a text commentary. So I just got the little snippets from that. But there's so many little... Mm. When you asked me for my memories, I thought, geez, I don't have too many memories of the League Cup. And then I put my name into Google and it went into overdrive. Sent off against West Ham in the 94th minute.
Did you deserve it?
I did, yeah. To be fair, it was a goal kick and Tom Heaton under hit the goal kick and West Ham won the header and they were through on goal straight away, rounded the goalkeeper and just as he's about to tap it into the back of the net, I just wiped him out. Yeah, the ref come over and it was a straight red and just as I thought I was going to get an absolute earful off of Sean Dyche for being sent off, he looked at me and went, I'm just surprised you were still running in the 94th minute, Keith. So fair play to you.
Yeah.
And yeah, the other one that really sticks with me is Burnley against Preston. This was after I'd left Preston to go to Burnley.
So let me set this up, right? Before you get into this story, if listeners are watching free kicks from outside the box and you're going to see sort of, you know, it's close enough to the edge of the box, you've got a six-man wall and then you'll see one player lie on the ground at the back like a doorstop.
Yep.
It's all your fault.
Yeah, apparently so. Again, I look back at this one and this was when Preston played Wigan back in 2010 and I scored a free kick to make it 1-0 to Preston. And I'll be totally, totally honest with you, Andrew. I was looking at the wall. There was a Scottish fella next to me called Paul Coutts and he went, just hit it, Keith. Just hit it. And I thought to myself, I tell you what, the fella on the last end of the wall, I'm going to fizz it at his head and I'm going to aim for the top corner. Totally, totally miskicked. It went under the wall and rolled into the back of the net. And ever since then, there's been a draft excluder. So yeah, Eliel Habsey was in goal for Wigan. They were a Premier League goal at the team, but honestly, absolutely miskicked the free kick and it went into the back of the net. And yeah, the one other standout memory I have is the Burnley and Preston game when I just left Preston to go to Burnley and we got them in the FA Cup and I was on the bench so I had to warm up in front of the Preston fans.
Lovely.
I just remember...
Lovely warm welcome.
Just a wave of... there were actually a lot of whiskey bottles being thrown at me at the time, so that's me overriding
empty
memory.
Empty or full?
Full, yeah. They really wanted to home. Yeah, they were throwing empty bottles, yeah. So that was 2013 and yeah, overriding memory was whiskey bottles being thrown at me as I warmed up.
Lovely, lovely. That's a way to welcome a former player back. Lots of action in the Europa League tonight as well. A couple of matches. Obviously, Celtic are away to Red Star Belgrade. That's an 8 o'clock start. And I mean, Celtic haven't been so impressive at the start of this year. You'd be sort of worried about them.
I am. You look at Celtic and you think, you know, you're worried about them at certain times, but it just seems to be so easy in the SPL for them at times. And even you never really see them being pushed. And you hear the narrative when you listen on Sky Sports, you think, Jesus, Celtic mustn't be doing well at all. And then you look at the SPL and think, seems pretty handy for them there. And I know people are saying it's Europe and they want to progress and they're a cash rich club and they don't seem to be spending to make that gap even bigger. You know, I'm not sure how much improvement Celtic can do. Even if they throw 50 million at it and get players in, how far are they going to go in the European competitions? But you look at this Red Star tonight, I think Celtic will have a little eye on going really deep into this tournament. The fact that Villa, Lyon, Roma, Rangers are there as well. There's some good clubs in there, but I think Celtic will be thinking getting out to the knockout stages at least.
You mentioned Roma there. They are away to Nice. And of course, we're all keeping a closer eye on Roma these days because of the loan signing of Evan Ferguson there. And he's made a great start. He hasn't scored too many goals in the when the season has started. He got a few in pre-season, but he has bedded down nicely. And we mentioned last night, he really sort of made himself even more popular with the Roma fans. They played Lazio at the weekend and they won 1-0. That was his first Roma derby as such, but he didn't score, but he did the next best thing, which was when he was being substituted off in the 66th minute, he just walked really slowly over to the sideline, and the whole of the Lazio team started to really, really get annoyed, to the extent that one of them had to be pulled off him before he got to the sideline, and he indeed got a yellow card a couple of minutes later. So very popular in Rome is young Evan Ferguson. Nice today, Nice aren't in great form in La Liga or in Liga, so Roma should fancy their chances there. And Real Betis at home to Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, this is a really good game. Obviously, Nottingham Forest have been out of European football now for, I think it's just over 30 years, struggling for any sort of momentum under Ange Postecoglou. I think it's a draw and two losses since he's come in the door. And a lot of people will be saying, Real Betis, you know, I might know a few players from there. There's quite a lot of players at Real Betis that Premier League fans will know. The likes of Hector Bellerin that was at Arsenal back in the day, Amrabat, Fornals, Anthony Lo Celso, Isco that was at Real Madrid. So they're a really, really slick team, Betis, and they've got Manuel Pellegrini as their manager, a brilliant tactician. They're currently sitting seventh in La Liga. So I think this will be an absolutely cracking game.
So what's Ange going to do? He's going to get 11 players behind the ball and just stop them, is he?
The total opposite. The absolute opposite of that. 11 players in front of the ball and go for it. But look, this is what the owner wants. The owner's obviously got rid of Nuno Espirito Santos, and I think we can all agree that it wasn't on football and performances. Maybe it was, you know, the way the team were going about it. Maybe they said they played with the handbrake on a little bit too much. But I think with Nottingham Forest, when you look at the likes of the players they've kept into the building, I know they've lost Alanga, but to keep Gibb White, to keep Anderson, who's now an English international, to bring Zinchenko in the door, Hudson-Odoi, Chris Wood, I think they've got the weapons as well. And they will be thinking, we've got Ange, he has a form in the European trophies. He obviously won one with Spurs last year. And I think that's what the Nottingham Forest owner will be looking for, his success in the cup.
Well, let's hope he wants the same thing in 6 months' time. He looks like he's a man that changes his mind quite regularly. A word before I let you go on the Ballon d'Or the other night. Ousmane Dembele was the winner. Lamine Yamal was the man to miss out. Your thoughts on it, and you've a couple of doubts.
I get, before I say I've a couple of doubts, I think Ousmane Dembele deserved it. I think he had the best season out of everybody. But when you look at the people that have won it over the last couple of years, and the technicians, and obviously Ronaldo and Messi come into that, I think we've probably been spoiled, because a lot of people are saying to me, Ousmane Dembele is not a great footballer, which I take the point. He's probably not a great footballer in terms of technical work, but 37 goals and 16 assists pretty much speak for themselves. And he was so, so good in that PSG team. And my mind goes back to him when he got slapped on the wrist for turning up late to a couple of team meetings and he got took out of the team. He's reacted so, so well. But when you look at who's come second in it, and young Lamine Yamal, only 18 years of age, absolutely brilliant. And the highest defender on the list is Hakimi, the PSG fullback. I'm not so sure you can call him an orthodox fullback. No. He's a very attacking fullback. Yeah. But even Rafinha, to finish fifth with 64 goal involvements. It's gone very, very high. Even Salah, 36 goals in all competitions, finishes fourth. But when you look at Yamal being 18, no player has ever won the Ballon d'Or before their 24th birthday. I'm fairly sure Yamal is going to do that.
He should have a good chance. Yep. Over the next couple of years. He's still got a few years to go. And I know his father expressed disappointment. He said he should have won it this year. But I suppose he would say that, wouldn't he?
A little bit harsh. Probably the only thing he hasn't won.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Keith, thank you very much for joining us on Game On this Wednesday evening. Just to let you know before I hit the break, we will have the hurling's highest ever senior score. We'll hear from Pa Horgan after he announced his retirement from the inter-county game just a little bit later on. After the break, golf and the Ryder Cup.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, it is less than 42 hours to the start of the Ryder Cup in Bethpage, New York. And let's cross over there now and join our own Greg Allen.
And welcome to Bethpage Park, State National Park, of course, the venue for the Ryder Cup here in New York. I'm joined, as usual, by Doug Ferguson, golf writer for Associated Press. Doug, every Ryder Cup brings with it its own USPs, you know, unique selling point. What's the unique selling point of this Ryder Cup in terms of the stories that are evolving and the teams that are playing each other, and this thing about home advantage being such a big factor in Ryder Cup, and it being maybe the biggest factor of all in a New York environment?
Yeah, I was nervous about Bethpage when they announced it in 2013 because it is the rowdiest place in golf in America. And that's for things like the Barclays and the PGA Championship. Now we're getting flags involved, we're getting two teams, we're getting sides involved, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, this is a loud and very passionate group. I always thought when they announced it that it was going to make Brookline look like a tea party, but the crowd's going to have a huge influence. Teams are very, I think, evenly matched. I always give the edge to Europe because they understand this competition better than the Americans do. But they are at home, and that's always an advantage. But it's just a matter of, does it get out of hand, and is it kept with good civility?
Are Ryder Cups in America, as Europe would perceive them, are they more sort of home advantage orientated because of the way that the crowd gets involved on the American side of the home advantage, perhaps in a manner of which European crowds wouldn't get involved? In other words, it's more intimidating in America.
I think it can be. I think intimidating can be a really good point. I always get a little bit offended when I heard that the American crowds are the worst and Europe's good, because when we'd go over to the Belfry or Celtic Manor or you name it, see how I'm leaving Ireland out of this, right? you hear stuff too. It's equal sides. But there is something different about the American fans. And I think one of the problems that the PGA of America has created is the number of ticket sales. I mean, it's hard enough to see with so many people here, but I think people, and that includes players, we tend to latch on to negativity. And so, like, Hazeltine to me was always the great example that there were only a few voices. There was a minority who was saying some really ugly things to Rory and to other people. But it was because ticket sales went from, say, 35,000 to 50,000. So the percentage is the same, but the actual number is greater. And there's more negativity, more ugliness that you're hearing that makes it look like the whole crowd is against you. I don't know if that makes sense, but the more people you bring, the higher the odds of stupid people saying stupid things, and you hear those.
Just in general, reflecting back on this recent history of matches being so one-sided, does the Ryder Cup need a 14.5, 13.5 this Sunday, or is it so big now that it just exists without needing to be close? Because historically, through the 80s and 90s, there were so many close matches.
I think we only talk about how close it is, and lately it isn't, on Sunday. Everything feels tense and tight, and then you get to Sunday and it's 17 to 11, and you're thinking, no drama there. There was a little bit of drama on Sunday in Marco Simone, not very long, certainly not like Medina. But yeah, I think it doesn't need it. I mean, it'd be nice to see. I think we'd all like to see, and we'd all like to pull our hair out and pinch our skin, trying to wonder what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, it's fine. It is a very peculiar streak, I guess, that you could say that we're on. It's Wednesday right now, and we all think this is going to be a tight one. And it could be 16 to 12 for all we know at the end of the week, either side.
And I remember in Marco Simone, because Europe won the first day 6.5 to 1.5, I think, and it was kind of set in agenda that Europe were going to go on and win. But it came right down to the singles on Sunday, and there were four singles on the course. Now, there was only one hole in all four of those singles matches at one point near the end of the back nine. If all of those matches, I know it's a big ask, were turned around to America, it would have been down to the wire. In many ways, Marcus Simone was probably not as much of a blowout as Medina should have been for the Americans. And then we saw the capacity for what happens when the flick of the switch and the emotional flick of the switch turns things around. Medina is now in the rearview mirror by 13 years. I think the Ryder Cup needs it, to be honest. Not so much for it to be the monster that it is, but to be an event that people really want to watch the next time when it comes to Ireland in Adair.
There's fairness to that. I think I still think it doesn't matter because it's still one of the greatest things going in golf, and everyone looks forward to it. But to your point of looking forward to the next one, I mean, right now, kind of to Rory's point, we're looking at, you know, Americans win at home, Europe wins on the road, and this is kind of the way it goes and what should happen, etc. You get a tight one. You get a Wales, you know, you get a Medina. Then you just, you know, 2 years can't get here fast enough.
Yeah, and I think actually you mentioned Wales in 2010. It could so easily have gone America's way in 2010. Let's face it, and you could have had an extraordinary away result both in 2010 and in 2012.
To be honest, Greg, from an American point of view, I always look back at why Europe hasn't won. Well, Nick Faldo probably wasn't the greatest captain, and that probably wasn't the greatest team, and that probably enabled the Americans to win in 2008. 2016, let's be honest, that was a really weak European team with rookies, with Chris Wood, with Andy Sullivan, with Danny Willett's brother. I mean, there was not a lot going on. That was a weakish European team. Whistling Straits, that was a very strong U.S. team, and never have I ever seen all the Americans on song in one week like that. But you also had zero support for Europe outside the rope. So I'm not so sure Europe has lost any of these matches since 1999, which is another kettle of fish I'd rather not revisit, but anyway.
And yet, matches like 1999 in Brookline, which obviously had a very raucous crowd participation, 1991, which America won in Kiawah Island, also had a very raucous crowd participation, they kind of defined the Ryder Cup. I mean, it's almost like the tribal element of the Ryder Cup is what separates it from being, you know, an individual contest for the Masters or the US Open or the PGA or the Open Championship. Maybe, you know, it's not a bad thing that you do have this very raucous tribal element, but you know, I'm not so sure it's necessary that it has to be over the edge as it might be here. We're delving into history here. Let's bring it right up to date. Scottie Scheffler had a poor Ryder Cup in Marco Simeone, no other way of putting it. Lost one of his matches by 9-8. That's 9 up with 8 to play. Got 1 point out of 4. He comes here as the runaway and very clear world number one, which he was also in Rome, but not to the level that he is right now. If Scottie Scheffler plays the way he can play, that's the difference in many ways between Marco Simeone and 2 years ago in Rome and here. Is Scottie Scheffler the key to this team, or is it much deeper than that?
He's a big key to the team, because what you always want is at least 3, if not 4 points from your top player. That's what Tiger Woods never delivered, to be fair. Dustin Johnson surely didn't in France when he was the world number one. And Scottie, as you pointed out, didn't in Rome last year. So if Scottie plays the way he does, even in team matches, and Russell Henley's been a good fit for him, then he would likely deliver points, because he has such great control of his golf ball, of his distance control, that he's rarely out of a hole, and you would expect him to win these points. You know, Bryson's another big factor for the U.S. in terms of what kind of energies he brings. There's always a few question marks, etc. But yeah, absolutely, it starts with Scottie. And I find what most interesting about Scottie and Rome is, even though he won the Masters in 22 and 4 other times that year, 24 and today is all about Marco Simone. He came back from Italy so disappointed with his play that he said this a couple weeks ago, that reshaped his thinking, his preparation, his work to allow 24 and 25 to happen. That all stemmed from Marco Simone.
Wow, okay. Well, you mentioned Bryson DeChambeau. We've seen the American team members and Captain Keegan Bradley leaning into this narrative that Bryson DeChambeau's points are going to be bigger if they're won than any other team member. Or, well, that's what Xander Schauffele basically alluded to, that if Bryson wins a point, it's more important than the point that I win, because Bryson leans into the crowd participation and will look to the crowd and, you know, whip them up. Do you agree with that?
I agree that he can be a spark, which is what also Xander had mentioned about a month ago. I don't buy into the fact that, you know, what they used to say about, what Monte used to say about Tiger, you know, it felt like winning 2 points. And I think you could apply that to Scottie, not as easily, but you can. Bryson, I just don't buy. I think Bryson's a showman. I think Bryson embraces the entertainment aspect of golf in the Ryder Cup, and he's kind of embodies kind of what the Ryder Cup's become. That's not a bad thing. He'll definitely engage the crowd, but I don't care who it is. It starts with the golf. And there's a lot of talk about Xander having not played in 5 weeks. Bryson hasn't played in 4. The only golf I know that Bryson's played is trying to hit those ping pong balls up into a little tiny glass to give somebody a Ferrari or something. I'm surprised that Poulter didn't sign up. But what kind of shape is he in? What kind of form is he in? I know he's played a limited schedule on LIV and has done well in a lot of the majors, but I'm more concerned about him, or as concerned as I would be about Xander Schauffele.
This is terrible. You're talking down the American team. This is not what we want. We want you to talk them up.
They're going to kill them.
Look, this so-called narrative as well about, you know, the American team not bonding as well as the European team, or maybe it's a case of the European team bonding better than the American team. They're very, very different cultures, even though so many of the European team players play on the PGA Tour. But what do you make of that so-called narrative, which has been going on really since Seve, you know, became that inspirational, emotional, driving force in the European team room back in the 1980s, where egos were parked at the door and Seve sprinkled his stardust inside but made everybody feel like he was their brother. And it seems to have stemmed from that, this so-called European unity. How does it compare to the American camaraderie and bonding?
All right, we'll get to that in a minute. However, this bonding business is the biggest pile of rubbish I've ever heard. There's a difference between unity and bonding. These Americans, these guys get on famously. Fast friends off the golf course, some of them vacation together. There is great bonding going on. In fact, I used to think the greatest part about European bonding, let's make it unity, is the fact they didn't like each other. I mean, it's true. You think Darren Clark was best buddies with Monty? Or Thomas Bjorn? Absolutely not. But they knew to get all the points they needed out of Monty, they needed him to make him feel like the greatest guy on earth, and they did that. I don't think Sergio and Jose Maria Olazabal were terribly close, because Sergio and Seve were never tight, and I think there was some spillover. But that week, they partnered, and they did well. So there's some discontent amongst European players over the years. But they need, as you say, parking the egos at the door. They needed to make sure that they were all one, all headed in the right direction. That's, to me, what they always did so brilliantly. I can't think of too many Americans or too many American teams where the boys didn't really genuinely enjoy the company, like each other, and so and so. But to the point of it all was something Paul Azinger said to me a couple years ago, and it's so true, and it's, to me, the heart of this Ryder Cup. He said about the Americans, it's in their head. But for Europe, he said it's in their blood. And that's the difference. The Americans want desperately to win the Ryder Cup. Some of them have been, like Justin Thomas is one that's in his blood. And I think Scotty, it's a lot in his blood. I'm not sure to what degree yet. But most of them want desperately to make the team. They want desperately to win. And then they go on with their lives. Europe wants desperately to win that week for themselves, for the unity. And they still think about it for the next 2 years until the next one. It is everything to them. I would think a lot of Europeans are more intent about what their Ryder Cup record is, and I'm talking about winning and losing teams, not so much personal record, as anything else they do in golf. And I don't think it's ever been that way toward a very individualistic thinking American way.
Okay, short question. Keegan Bradley versus Luke Donald, the respective captains. How important is that in terms of determining the outcome of the match?
That's a short question and a hard one to answer, and I kind of wish you'd go on to the next one. But Luke was brilliant last time, and he was very much, to me, reminded me a lot of Bernhard. Very much a quiet person, but so methodical and attention to detail. He was brilliant that way. It's a tough ask coming in to do a very similar team when you can't help but think of 2 years ago, when this is a new place and a new start, new attitudes, new everything. That's going to be tough for Luke. And that's his challenge. Keegan, I think, has pushed every button the right way. Keegan's got a lot of passion for the Ryder Cup. He's only played in two of them. He hasn't been a part of any of them in 11 years. This is kind of homish for him in terms of going to college and having a history here. And I think he's done really well at putting the team in front of himself. And I thought it was brilliant when he left himself off the team but kept everybody else guessing. Including me, by the way. I mean, we were all at Eastlake on Sunday thinking, wow, is he going to play or is he not? I'm not sure. What do you think? Back and forth. And it turns out Keegan knew all along. But he shows up Wednesday to announce the captain's picks and said, I decided a while ago. But what he showed to his team was, it's about us winning the cup with you. Leave me out of it. Like, I'm going to be selfless here and step aside. He knew all along he wasn't playing. But the message he gave to his team was, this is all about you and it's all about winning. What I've heard from the Americans over the last 3 or 4 months is that Keegan really doesn't care about anything but one thing, and that's winning the cup. And so I think they have felt that. Now, we could talk details and clothing and pairings and everything else, but the message he's been giving them is win this cup at any cost.
Rory McIlroy, I have to bring you around to Rory at some point, so I'm going to do it right now, and for a reason. Rory has said that one of the big achievements in golf is winning a Ryder Cup away from home, which was done in Medina in Chicago in 2012 in the most extraordinary comeback circumstances. It's not called a miracle in Medina for no reason. Is he right?
You know, he's got history on his side, doesn't he? And yeah, you look at Europe having not done this since Medina, and only four times since Europe became, you know, part of the mix. It's more a case of the Americans not having done it since 1993. And there must be a reason for it. But frankly, the biggest reason for it was the Americans never gave themselves a chance in the early 2000s. Their point structure for making the team gave us Von Taylor and Brett Wederich in 2006. It gave us Chris Riley and Fred Funk in 2004. Only when Paul Azinger modernized and took stock of what was happening in worldwide golf and adjusted it to get the proper team up has it been kind of a home and away, home and away. And Rory would be the first to tell you that Medina was a fluke, and it was. I mean, it was a matter of Justin Rose making a 45-foot putt and everything going right, and so be it, and fair play and all that good stuff. But is it hard? I'm not sure. I mean, I would have fancied the Americans' chances in Italy if they could do it all over again. Why didn't they win? Maybe because they didn't play golf for 5 weeks, possibly. I'm not sure they had the greatest captain. I would definitely say they didn't have the greatest captain in the right picks. But if they'd had carried forward from Whistling Straits, different players, but the same kind of attitude and leadership, that might have been different. So I'm not answering your question for about the 100th time today, but it is a huge achievement, the biggest. No, I think we need more time on this one.
It's funny, actually, there is a statistic. You mentioned 93 and America's last victory on European soil. Since then, there have been 7 Ryder Cups on American soil, and Europe have won 3 of them. So I'm going to ask you the question, is it going to be a home victory?
Another one I'm not answering. How many does that make? I think it will. Just a hunch. I have no idea. I never know who's going to win coming into these things because they all look so good. There's a lot of unknowns on the American side. J.J. Spahn, who never admitted the other day that he never even dreamed of being in the Ryder Cup, much less a year ago. He's played lovely golf this year, and I expect him to play well this year. Sometimes when you get kind of one-off major winners, they do well the rest of the year. Russell Henley, to me, had a good President's Cup last time, big deal. He's a nice putter and a nice player. Ben Griffin, we don't know much about. I mean, there's still some unknowns on the American side, but it's still got great strength from Cantlay, from Scheffler, from Justin, Bryson, you would expect. Europe has got a team, you know, the same 12 faces, as I like to say, that it's already proved how good they can be last year. I think it'll be really close, like you want. Just a hunch, the Americans might win this one.
I have a feeling that the experience of Whistling Straits, which was so chastening for Europe, I think is part of the driving force and them feeling that this victory on away soil is extremely important. And I think it will be a case of it being a close one. Because I do think the Ryder Cup needs a close one. It doesn't need it for the event to be big and, you know, this extraordinary transcending golf event as it is. But I think we'd all like to see a 14.5, 13.5 and a bit of heartache come Sunday evening. Doug Ferguson, Associated Press golf correspondent, thanks so much for joining us on Game On.
Always a pleasure, Greg.
Game On.
Hurling. Now, All-Ireland champions Tipperary have won 13 nominations for the PWC All-Stars for 2025, and the Premier County also dominate the shortlist for Hurler and Young Hurler of the Year, though captain Ronan Maher surprisingly not in the running for the biggest prize of all. The Hurler of the Year will be chosen by the playing fraternity and will be one of this year's outstanding sharpshooters, Tip's John McGrath, Jake Morris and Cork's Brian Hayes all have been nominated for the Hurler of the Year, but amongst the forwards is a young man by the name of Patrick Horgan, who at the age of 37 yesterday announced his retirement from intercounty duty with Cork. The forward, he turned 37 in May, suffered his fourth All-Ireland final defeat, and that was to Tipperary, of course, 2 months ago. Despite a Celtic cross eluding him, Horgan was named as an All-Star 4 times so far. He could make that 5 in a, probably should make that 5 in a couple of weeks' time. He won four Munster titles, including this year after Cork also claimed the Allianz hurling crown. He also holds the record for points scored in both the championship, 32 goals, 683 points, and ahead of Kilkenny's TJ Reid. And the league, his total in the league is 26 goals, 674 points. He announced his retirement yesterday. Today he spoke to our Gaelic Games correspondent Marty Morrissey.
Talk to me, Patrick, about your decision to retire, to step back from the Cork intercounty scene. Was that a difficult decision?
Yeah, very hard, obviously. After being there so long and being such a big part of my life. I had it in my mind, I suppose, since the final, and you know how hard that was to take and all that. But it's something I just kind of put away for a good few weeks because we were playing championship with the Glen, and after being knocked out last week, it kind of had a bit of time, and there's a few things, and it was obviously hard to see Pat Ryan go as well, and the way he went, and even my small fellow home, Jack, he's going to be getting bigger, and I'll be out of the house an awful lot, 5-6 days a week, and it's not fair on him either, and I want to see him.
Did you have a chat with Ben O'Connor?
No, I get on really well with Ben, actually. And I wish him nothing but the best, obviously, in the role. It's a very hard position he's taken up. But he's taken on an unbelievable bunch of players, I suppose. They're still, you know, great side. Nothing has changed there. Yeah. And a lot of good friends of mine, and I hope to God they can get over the line, yeah.
I mean, you've done it all, Munster Championships, All-Stars, National League, but obviously the one that you missed out on after four All-Ireland finals was the All-Ireland medal. Does that bother you? Does it kind of give you sleepless nights? Does it concern you?
Not so much. Obviously, I'd be silly. If I didn't say a hurt not winning one, probably especially the last one, being the position we were in. But as a whole, I said this for a long time, I was nearly hoping we'd win it so I could even double down on this point there. It's not everything. We train a lot, and we went down the road playing a lot of games, and I enjoyed every bit of it. And I wouldn't change any of that for a medal. If I didn't enjoy it and won a medal, it wouldn't have been for me or whatever. But no, I obviously it's a bit of a regret, but it's not everything for me now.
Going back to that All Ireland final, I'm sure you've heard all the rumours about the row at half time and the Glen Rovers lads were particularly involved. I mean, obviously that was untrue, I presume.
Yeah, we're always involved. Sure, we're always throwing slaps somewhere, I suppose. We've been told we are anyway. But it couldn't have been further from the truth. I suppose anyone that has ever been in a GA dressing room would know that it's probably nearly impossible that some of the stories could have even happened. Mm. Even Hayes. I was actually on the phone to Hayes a while ago, and he said, "Make sure and bring this up," which is funny. Yeah, but. it's silly stuff, but that's what happens when you're playing, I suppose, the level we're playing, and people want to kind of knock you in some form, yeah.
You've been 18 years wearing that Cork jersey and won the admiration, not alone of friend and foe and in Cork, but nationwide. This is going to be a dramatic change, I would imagine. I mean, have you any plans?
No. Play with the Glen, probably annoy all them. I got a couple of messages actually yesterday saying January won't be the same because they won't be local Mac in any conditions. So they're probably right, but no, just go back and enjoy that. Jack is starting under fours in the Glen as well at the moment, so I'll have to bring him up there a couple of times a week, and we'll see after that.
I'm sure we'll hear of Jack Horgan in the future, I would think.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Well done, and nice congratulations on a great career.
Nice one, thanks very much.
That is Pat Horgan talking to Marty Morrissey, and let's hope we do see Jack in a couple of years' time. Delighted to say I am joined on the line by former Donegal intercounty player and captain and former Westmeath coach and Fianna coach Nadine Doherty. Nadine, how are you? Happy Wednesday to you.
I'm great. You too, Andrew. Good to be chatting.
Yeah, great to chat to you as well. On Monday, we had the latest update from the Steering Group on Integration, the SGI, which sounds a bit more sexy, chaired by former President Mary McAleese. The amalgamation of the GA, the Camogie Association and the Ladies Gaelic Football Association still ploughing away. We've still no real idea of when it'll be finished, but we've got to trust the process, I suppose.
Yeah, and I suppose I am one of the the people who trust the process. With the statement, Andrew, you know, they're always welcome. They're scant enough. This has probably been the most detailed that we've seen in any of them. And I suppose they've kind of been biannual, maybe three a year, but the last couple of years have been two. The language is positive, as always. It's optimistic. It's a confident tone. So nothing has changed in that regard. But I suppose what this does show us is a slight pathway towards 2027. You know, these nine core principles that they've outlined, they said they'll have to go to each Congress. So now that they've released them, it gives time for them to be debated outside of Congress. And then you'd imagine they'll all go to Congress in 2026. I suppose the stickler there is, if they're not passed at each Congress, then 2027 may not be the realistic date for it. But so as you do look back, you know, considering that each Congress voted overwhelmingly in 23, 2022, 23, whatever it was, you know, they all voted overwhelmingly for integration. It's very hard to see them, you know, sticking on any of these core principles. Kind of as we expected, they're relatively straightforward, but, you know, a few you would like a little bit more detail, perhaps. But I think all in all, you know, it's good. It is good. And it does show a little bit of progress. What I would love to know, though, they talk about these working groups all the time, and they're definitely the people who are carrying out the biggest load in the process. You know, we know who's involved at the big table, let's say the hierarchy end of things. But, you know, it's these working groups who are working and they're collaborating with the people on the ground. You know, they're looking at the logistics of the whole thing in terms of communications, facilities, finance, fixtures, games development and so on. So you'd love a little bit more detail on those working groups and who and what they're made up of, because we haven't had any detail on them as of yet.
Is there anything, I suppose, let's run down through sort of the brief headlines to see, because there's a few things that I don't think anyone will really sort of be too bothered about. All three bodies will come under the name of the GA.
That's no surprise there, Andrew. No. We figured that. I mean, in terms of the LGFA, I do know that there would be a large cohort of people out there who will be, I suppose, disappointed and sad to see, you know, ladies football as such be dissolved in that sense in title. But then I suppose there's also possibly, you know, a younger cohort of people coming through who see ladies football as being outdated, a little bit obsolete maybe in terms of, you know, ladies. It's women's football, you know, it's women who are playing it. So I think that would be a split in terms of losing that that name. But yeah, it was always going to be the GA, Andrew.
And a single membership, no real problem with that, is there?
Well, it's, you know, it's going to make the admin side of things a lot easier for those at club level, essentially, who are tasked with organising, sending off different paperwork. It'll be great for families and clubs in that regard. From an LGFA perspective, my concern is, you know, will that mean that the injury fund, which is part of the LGFA membership, will that be scrapped? Because I know it has come in for a lot of criticism recently in terms of the cap that it has. But I mean, overall, I think it's an amazing financial resource for female footballers in this country. Mm. Like, there's no other female sport in the country that offers financial assistance to its players when they're injured. And I think the LGFA should get huge, huge credit for that. So if that goes, and I suppose the female players aren't given the same financial backing that male players are, then that could be massive, I think. So I really hope that is negotiated, that it will stay in. And you'd hope it's moved across to Camogie as well. You'd love to see them have that, because especially for club players, you know, you get some counties whereby the female intercounty player are looked after. It's very rare, but you do in some counties. But club players, that injury fund is massive. It's amazing.
And speak about in the clubs, the one thing that I think needs, from my uninformed eyes, needs a little bit of clarification. Where separate Camogie, GA or ladies football clubs currently exist within the same area, decisions regarding potential mergers or amalgamations will remain at the discretion of the local units. The approach and timing will also be determined locally. That seems a bit wishy-washy.
Yeah.
At this, it's an early stage, obviously, of this process.
Yeah, that did stand out to me as well. There's parts of it I didn't even, you know, a duplicate club or whatever. I think in that area, I hope, and you'd hope, that some support will be offered to those clubs if the mergers are being negotiated, because that could get extremely tricky depending on the local politics of the area, and depend on the want for a one club model. I think that's where the GPA could come in. They're on the sidelines right now. They haven't been involved in the process at all. But, you know, the people involved there are excellent negotiators. They're really good at bringing things together. So maybe, you know, maybe they could be well placed to play a role in that area. I don't know if they've been thought of, but I think their involvement in some capacity there. And I think in the process as a whole, in the near future, I think it would be great to get the GP involved in some way. And I think the majority of GA people would welcome that as well.
Nadine, thanks very much for joining us this evening. That's all we have time for tonight. Shane Dawson will be back here tomorrow from 6 o'clock to talk rugby, American football, soccer and, of course, the Ryder Cup. Up next here on 2FM, it is the new music show. And we're in for a proper treat tonight because my man, Beto da Silva, has been raiding his archives to bring us a show full of bangers. That's all after the news, but first, a break.
This is 2FM.